and welcome to the Houston Innovators Podcast. I'm Natalie Harms, editor of Innovation Map. This podcast is brought to you by Texas Citizens Bank. Through good and tough times, you need a bank that will stand by you. Texas Citizens Bank gives Houston small and medium-sized businesses the resources they need to thrive. As one customer says, a huge thank you to our friends at Texas Citizens Bank. Great customer service and down-to-earth good people. Call 713-948-5700 to learn more today. My guest for this episode is Kira Doolin, Managing Director at Texas Halo Fund, an early-stage venture capital firm based in Houston. While Halo is industry agnostic when it comes to its portfolio, Kira joins the show today to discuss how fintech has really appeared as a focus for her and the fund, mostly due to the incredible opportunities the underfunded industry provides. She also shares some advice for both fintech founders and women interested in getting involved in the investor landscape. Kira, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
So just to start, would you take it away with telling us a little bit about your background and how you got into this investment world?
Yeah, so I started by attending meetings at the Houston Angel Network probably about 7 years ago. I started that when I moved back to Houston. I had been living in China before that. And my dad was retiring and he wanted to get into angel investing. And I had an MBA and I was interested in entrepreneurship, interested in startups. And he asked if I would come along with him. So I started to go to those meetings with him. Fast forward a few years, I started to work for one of the startups that we invested in, NextSeed, which is a Houston-based startup that does crowdfunding online. So it's debt-based crowdfunding. You can invest in, you know, your favorite local gym or your favorite local coffee shop through their platform. So I started working for them. I've been working for startups ever since. I have a background in marketing and marketing and sales mainly. And I love the startup ecosystem. I think startups are so interesting to be a part of. They're so interesting to talk to. You know, you get a different level of energy when you're talking to founders. So I think it was about 3.5 years ago, the Halo Fund managing directors, the previous ones from Halo One, they were looking to start Halo Two and they were looking to bring more people on. And they'd seen me at the meetings. I'd met them through the Houston Angel Network and I was lucky enough to get a seat on that team. So I started with Texas Halo Fund, about 2.5 years ago. And since starting with Halo Two, I've done Halo Three and Halo Four, and I've really enjoyed getting to invest in companies both in Houston and beyond and really get to start, you know, helping these founders along by giving them the investment dollars they need to do the things that they're trying to do. So that's a little bit of my background.
For the Texas Halo Fund, you know, what's the history there and what's the market that, you know, you and your fellow managing directors have carved out for Texas Halo Fund?
Yeah, you know, I think Halo originally started out of this desire to really open this asset class up to people who were interested in investing in it and didn't necessarily want to be angel investors on their own or just didn't have the time or the funds to create the sort of portfolio that you generally need to create as an angel investor. So typically, people will tell you that you need at least 10 companies in your portfolio if you're going to invest in these early stage companies. And typically those companies are looking for you to write checks that are $25,000 and above. So if you're an individual investor, that's $250,000 that you're looking to put to work in this space, which, you know, for a lot of people isn't feasible or just isn't something that they want to do, or they're not comfortable doing that right away. And then on top of that, they show that at least 20 hours of due diligence on each company that you're investing in leads to much higher results. And, you know, even beyond that 20 hours, you're getting better results. So for a lot of people, just the time commitment is tough to do as well. And then if you're an individual doing angel investing, I think people tend to stick to what they know. So they'll invest in the space that their career was in or that their background is in. And I think that that leaves a lot of opportunities on the table. So if you're somebody who worked in energy, investing in life science companies might seem, you know, you don't have the expertise to bring to the table to really feel comfortable with that. So you're leaving whole sectors behind. So the idea with Texas Halo Fund was that we would create a diverse portfolio of deals. Each of our funds has about 20 to 25 companies in it. And we have managing directors who come from all different backgrounds. So my background is mainly retail, marketing, consumer-facing products. But my fellow managing directors, you know, we have a lot of experience in life science, in tech. So we're able to kind of leverage each other's expertise to create that diverse portfolio when we're looking at doing due diligence. And then by bringing those companies together, people invest directly in us. The check size that they're writing to us is much lower than that $250,000 that they'd need to do to get that 10 company portfolio on their own. So I think it gives people an opportunity to get into early stage investing, angel investing. It makes it a lot more economically feasible for them to do so. And they can be as involved as they want to be. So for each company we invest in, we do due diligence. We put together a report that we send out to our members. So, you know, they can look at how we're screening these deals, why we've made the decision to invest. They can invest on their own in those deals if they choose to. If they think something stands out to them and they want to do that, they can. Or they can just sit back and let us invest their money, and they've got exposure to something that's very different, rather than just invest in the stock market or what else it might be. So that's really why we started Halo Fund. And we've continued it because we've seen that people are always interested in investing in this space. And so what we do is we try to always have a fund that's open to new investors so that we're able to allow people in if they want to be part of it.
So how do you and your team, how do y'all find these companies? What are you really looking for? It does sound like you have a diversity of industries, but how do you decide, you know, what companies you're investing in?
You know, as far as finding the companies, honestly, at this point, we screen so many companies that deal flow is not an issue. I'd say we look at over at least 1,000 companies a year. So we're getting inbounded by a lot of people. We're part of various angel networks. So we're a part of Houston Angel Network. So we're getting deal flow from those networks. We're also getting deal flow from other funds that we, you know, we have relationships with that we know. We'll share deal flow with people like that. I would say we get some deal flow from founders. So founders tend to meet other founders and they'll say, hey, you sound like a good fit for Halo Fund. They'll send that company over to us. So we get deal flow from a variety of ways. And then we just get a ton of inbound deal flow through LinkedIn, through our email. As far as what we're looking for, we're early stage. So I think that's something that sets us apart. We're really looking to get in pretty early on in these companies. So we're looking to get in when they're valued at maybe $2 to $3 million, upwards of $9 to $10 million. We typically don't play much later than that, unless it's a company that's already in our portfolio. So we like to get in early. We're what you would, I guess, historically consider to be pre-VC, but now that is getting a little bit more blurred. We're typically coming in after maybe there was a friends and family type round or maybe an early seed round. But we're some of the earlier capital that's invested. And then we are continuing to make investments as that company does subsequent rounds. So early stage, you know, we're looking for strong founders. We're looking for innovative products, innovative solutions. We're looking for a true market need. So we're really trying to make sure that whatever solution that they're bringing to the table, there is really a demand for that. And I think one thing that sets us apart in Houston is that I would say at least a third of all of our portfolios is life science based. And I think a lot of groups tend to shy away from that for a variety of reasons, you know, FDA regulatory sort of things. And then just also expertise and timeline of how some of those deals play out. But we're willing to really look at any industry.
Yeah, well, something that one of the reasons we're talking today is because you've seen FinTech in particular, you know, even though you have this, you know, wide range of startups you're looking at and across industries, FinTech is one that's emerged naturally as a focus for you and for Texas Halo Fund. So how has that happened? What does FinTech really mean? And why has this emerged as a huge opportunity?
You know, I think FinTech, so for Halo One invested in a FinTech deal, Materna, years and years ago before I ever got involved. So they've been investing in FinTech since before FinTech was really much of a conversation. And we've recently made another investment in that same company, Materna Medical, which have two products. They've got a product that is a dilator that's used during childbirth. So it opens up the birth canal to try to make it so that women don't have the injuries that they usually sustain during childbirth. So about half of women end up with incontinence or prolapse by the age of 55. And a lot of those are women who have delivered babies. So the product naturally opens things up and kind of stretches things out before a workout sort of thing, so that that's not happening. So that company has been in the Halo portfolio for quite some time. The first femtech deal that I brought into the portfolio, I had had my son, and I think he was like 2 or 3 weeks old, and I got an email from a company called Keg. Lady Technologies is their official name, but Keg is the product. And they're a fertility device that is designed to measure cervical fluid and detect a full fertile window. So I took a call with her because after talking to my doctor when I wanted to get pregnant, I started to understand that there were a lot of gaps in understanding your own fertility. I think for so long, women are taught how not to get pregnant, and we're not actually taught that much about how our bodies actually work. And so when you go to get pregnant, you're like, oh, wow, this is a whole different world that I didn't understand about. And I think a lot of people struggle with infertility, and a lot of that can just be that they don't understand their own cycle, or they have an irregular cycle, or they suffer from PCOS or any of these various conditions. So I think I was primed to want to hear from companies that were femtech because I had already just gone through this process of getting pregnant, having my son, and then, you know, what that looks like after and what people are calling the fourth trimester. So I think where I was in my life opened my eyes to how big this market was and just some of the issues that women faced. And that's only talking about one small segment of the femtech market, which is fertility and childbirth. There's also, you know, menopause and just hormonal issues related to just being a woman. And then, you know, how various diseases are different for women and men's bodies. So I think I was at a stage in my life where I had opened my eyes into what really the gaps that were there and the fact that a lot of these conversations weren't being had. And then in looking into Keg, it showed me just what the market was and how many gaps there were in the market just around fertility. And so we invested in Keg. And then from there, maybe a year after that, we invested in a company called MFB Fertility, which has a product called Proof, which is the first at-home FDA urine-based test for PDG, which is the urine metabolite of progesterone. And that company was really interesting to me because there's a lot of products on the market that can tell you when you should be ovulating. There's not a lot of products that tell you if you actually did. So, you know, you can go, your doctor will tell you go 6 months to a year if you are looking to try to get pregnant before you come back in and do any sort of testing. And I think, you know, a lot of women are having babies later. And when they're ready to have a baby, they're ready to have a baby. It's like, I want to do this now. It's not, oh, I can wait a year and just see what happens. So that particular company is really interesting because it gives people the knowledge of whether or not they're actually ovulating, which is a powerful thing to then take to your doctor. But I think femtech in general, I think a lot of the issues that face women are things that are not talked about. I think, you know, 1 in 4 pregnancies end in a miscarriage. No one talks about that. My first pregnancy ended in a miscarriage, which showed me that whole world and that whole side of things. And my doctor was just like, yeah, you know, just keep trying, see what happens next time. Whereas there's some of these products like Proof that shows you, hey, your progesterone isn't where it's supposed to be. You can take a simple supplement that can keep things like that from happening. These things are just, they're starting to be talked about, but they're not talked about. Injury during childbirth, you know, people tearing, people having prolapse, urinary incontinence. I think for a long time, women just sat back if they had these issues and they kept it to themselves and they were told to keep it to themselves. And so those problems weren't being addressed. And doctors kind of, you know, I think the medical community in general just kind of said, yeah, you know, these things happen. That's just what we have to accept. But I think women more and more are starting to stand up for themselves. They're starting to talk about these things. They're starting to talk about menopause. They're starting to talk about hot flashes. They're starting to talk about the issues that they face after having a child. They're starting to talk about the challenges related to breastfeeding. All of these things are starting to come to the forefront, which is great because I think more and more people are realizing, hey, this wasn't just my experience. This is actually the experience of a lot of people around me. And that's then leading to women deciding to find companies around this. Proof, you know, it was her own experience with having to go through IVF the first time for her first child and then realizing that she had an issue with progesterone and fixing it and being able to conceive naturally after that with the second child that led to her then wanting to help other women with this issue. So I think having more and more women who are realizing, hey, this is not just my issue. This is an issue that faces a lot of us that comes out of those conversations that are being had. That's leading to more and more of these companies being founded. I think there is still so much space for innovation that I think it makes it a wonderful area to invest in. I think the other end of the problem here is that VCs tend to be mostly made up of men. Venture capital dollars are generally going to male-run startups. And I think people know this. Something like 12% of decision makers when it comes to investing are women. So that's a small amount. And I think that women understand the issues other women are facing. Like I said, for me, if I had seen Keg, the fertility company, before I had ever tried to have a baby, I don't know if I would have been as receptive to the company as I was in the state that I was when I was pitched by them, when I had a 2-week-old baby literally lying on me while I was hearing the pitch from the founder. So I think bringing women to the table as far as investors go starts to increase the number of dollars that are being put into femtech. Very small amounts of investment dollars are actually going into women-led companies, and women tend to be the ones who are creating these femtech companies because it's issues that they're facing. So I think there's a lot of opportunity in this market just because there's been so little that's been done in this market.
I mean, you've kind of just described the perfect storm for fintech, you know, completely underfunded industry that's burgeoning by all of these conversations, you know, finally starting. And it just seems like, you know, it's we go to the doctor as women, we go to the doctor one time a year kind of thing. So it's like, this hasn't been on a lot of people's minds until it happens to them perfectly, which is how you described it perfectly. So, I mean, do you see this as this huge opportunity for investment because, you know, femtech is here and it's arriving in this perfect storm of, you know, circumstances?
Yeah, I mean, I really do. I think that women are starting to stand up for themselves more. They're starting to make their voices heard more and more. I mean, that's a trend that's not going to go away. I think that, you know, our parents' generation, they didn't have the internet. They didn't have all of this information at their fingertips. And so I think for us, we're facing some sort of issue, we can at least take to Google and realize that it's not just us. And I think that's bringing a lot of these issues that women face to the forefront. For a long time, you know, just traditionally, women weren't allowed to be part of drug trials if they were of childbearing age. So women's bodies haven't been studied as much as men's bodies. So just from that standpoint, I think there's a lot to be done here. Only 20% of OBGYNs and primary care doctors are actually trained in menopause and how to treat a patient who is going through menopause. But 80% of women, something around that, experience hot flashes. So, you know, you look at numbers like that, and there's just such a gap between what the need is and how that's being addressed. So I think this is a market that's going to just keep growing because I think women are demanding better. And I think that's a wonderful thing. And I think that the trend is more and more women being on the investor side, and they're going to stand up for these deals and they're going to try to fight to get these deals through. As a female investor, that's something that I'm really passionate about. And I'm glad that I'm able to explore the femtech market through working for Halo Fund. You know, I think it's something like 3% of investment dollars goes to women-led startups. And that's even gone down. In 2020, that fell to something like 2.3%. I think there's definitely room for growth here. I will say that at Halo, 25% of our companies have a female founder. And if you look at Halo 2 and beyond, that number goes up to about 35%. So I am happy that we're doing better than average. I'm not saying it's perfect because 50-50 is better, but you know, it's definitely improving. But I think as you're bringing more and more women onto the VC side of things, onto the investor side of things, they're going to start supporting these companies, and you're going to see more and more of these companies just coming out of the woodwork in general, because women are demanding better, as they should.
Yeah. I mean, that's another, I guess, trend that's not going anywhere is I think VCs are, at least in Houston, are more aware of, you know, bringing a diverse set of people to the table, to the decision-making table within their companies. So that's changing. How do you feel about Houston in this space? I mean, obviously a much younger ecosystem able to learn from these mistakes of more developed ecosystems. Do you think Houston has a good opportunity to change that, move the needle a little bit on both fintech and women in investment?
I think Houston definitely does. You know, Houston is a very diverse city just in its own right. And I think you see a lot of interest in moving that forward. So just with the funds that we have in town, you know, we've got funds that are focused on women. You've got Artemis Fund that is focused on investing in women. You've got, you know, incubators and funds that are focused on getting more just diversity in founders in general, which I think is great. I think if you're not addressing the issue of investing in women, investing in diverse founders, investing in different kinds of people, you're selling yourself short as a fund in general, because you're leaving out huge segments of the population. So I think that Houston is a great space for that, because I think we've recognized in Houston that we are a diverse city in a lot of different ways, from the people who live here to the sort of industry that we have here. I think we recognize that that's one of our strong suits. And so I think that just because we understand that, you know, we're definitely in a place to take advantage of that diversity. And I think we do. I think that Houston, you know, when you're looking at the coast, valuations are high, cost of living is higher than here, although Houston is definitely going up. I think that that's something that's a positive about Houston. And I think that in a lot of ways, COVID has been positive for places that are not traditionally seen as startup hubs and VC hubs, because people are getting more and more used to taking pitches from companies all over the place virtually, whereas before that wasn't necessarily a trend. People wanted to actually meet these founders in person. And so a lot more was happening locally maybe than it is now. I think, you know, we're thought of as being the energy capital, which we definitely are. And I think there's a lot of trends there towards clean energy, towards renewable energy. And I think Houston is poised to be at the forefront of that. But I think we also have the medical center, which makes us a huge hub for life sciences and life science investment. We've got tech companies here. We've got all kinds of things that are happening in Houston that make it a really interesting place for startups and for investing in general. And then we have two great universities. I mean, UH, their entrepreneurship program, I think the undergraduate entrepreneurship program is number one in the country and has been ranked number one in the country. And then you've got Rice's graduate program, I think is ranked number one as well. So you have it starting in schools as well, which is awesome to see.
When it comes to FinTech, I mean, obviously we've talked a little bit about this niche within that, within fertility. What other trends do you see coming out of FemTech, and where is that industry evolving? What are you keeping a close eye on within FemTech?
Yeah, one other company that we recently invested in, Work and Mother, is a Houston-based company that is creating fully equipped lactation facilities in, you know, big office buildings that are designed to support women and to make it easier for employers to support women in their breastfeeding journey. So I think supporting women in the workplace is another area of FemTech that, you know, we haven't really touched on so far. What I love about what they're doing is they've really thought it through to where the building is getting a lot from having them in there. It's kind of like having a gym in your building. You know, you're able to provide this additional resource that makes it appealing for a company to lease space in your building. And then for employers, you know, a lot of employers, they don't know what you need in a lactation room for women, especially some of these smaller companies, and they might not have the space within their office to create that. You know, you hear stories of women pumping in their own office and bathroom stalls and their cars, then having to walk through shared office space with all of the parts that go along with that, and having to store their breast milk in a common fridge, and just things that are unappealing. A lot of women want to stay in the workforce now, and a lot of them end up dropping out because they're not being supported. So I think there's going to be a trend around that as well. And I think Work and Mother is doing a great job. Their facilities literally look like you're going to a spa. So taking an experience that has traditionally been challenging and not so great and putting a spin on it and making it actually an enjoyable experience where you can choose to sit in a lounge chair, you can choose to sit at a desk, and you're in a private space and it's a nice looking space. And, you know, they have an app to go along with it that they're building out more and more, but you can connect with other working mothers. You're getting support that you need there as well. The founder, she's an MBA, but she's also a lactation consultant. So I think, you know, opening up the conversation about how hard breastfeeding is just in general is another area of femtech, supporting women through that process. So I think that's a big one. I think also menopause is a area that really has not been touched. And there's a lot of opportunity around that as well. You know, just understanding your hormonal imbalances and how you can treat that versus just being told to just kind of sit back and deal with it. So I think that's a big one.
A lot of opportunity in both of those areas too. I mean, especially Work and Mother, where I think after a year plus of, you know, remote work and a lot of companies having to pivot their workforce in that way, being so much more intentional with the office space that you provide your employees. It's, you know, making that difference and providing something, you know, versus, I mean, we prove that we can work from home, but now what are the opportunities for working in the office? I feel like that's an opportunity there for Work and Mother and for Abby. So it's very interesting.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on that. I think that, you know, I think that COVID has been good for people in some ways, in that it has exposed that remote work and flexible work is something that's possible. And I think that's going to be a great trend for women and for parents in general. But I do think people want to get back into an office. They want to be back in a collaborative space. And a company like Abby's makes it a lot more appealing to go back and a lot easier to go back. And I think also, you know, you're looking at socially distancing, and that trend coming and going as variants come and go and CDC recommendations change, you know, so you want to have a safe space for women to be pumping, a clean space, and they're providing that. So I think that's another good trend for them.
We've talked a lot about the changes of femtech and the evolving decision makers within VCs, but what still needs to be done to make sure that femtech is being properly, you know, invested in, and these innovations are coming to light and getting to market? What sort of things do we need to not only, you know, keep that door open, but, you know, open it wider and wider until it's more of a fair opportunity?
Yeah, I think increasing the number of women who are investors is a wonderful way to do that, because women understand these issues because they've gone through them. So 12% of decision makers at VC firms being women, that's not high enough. I think it would be wonderful to continue to see that number going up. And just women investors in general, you know, at these angel groups, it is predominantly male. And so women just themselves showing up and deciding to try to invest, I think, is a wonderful thing. I think women tend to be more, this is obviously a generalization, but I think women are more risk averse. Maybe we're taught to be that way. So I think when you look at angel investing, all of that is traditionally been more male. And so I think by bringing women to the table as investors, they start to see these opportunities and they want to invest in these opportunities. So I think that needs to continue to go up. That number needs to continue to go up. The amount of funding that's going into these companies, that needs to go up as well. Having, you know, 2.3% of investment dollars going into women-run companies in 2020, that's too low. And, you know, some femtech companies probably have male founders, but the majority of these companies have female founders. So that number needs to go up as well. And I think women just in general need to continue to push the envelope and to demand better outcomes for themselves, because keeping it a conversation that is going on, making people more and more aware of it is going to encourage people who have ideas around the space to pursue them. It's going to encourage investors to invest in the space as they start to really understand the potential upside of the space in a lot of different ways. So I think getting women at the table to invest, having women encouraged to actually bring their ideas to the table as far as starting companies, all of these things I think are wonderful. I think it's wonderful that we're starting to see investment groups that are looking to invest in female-run startups, but I think that we need to see that diversity outside of just that. I think funds that are looking to invest in women, that is a fantastic thing, but we need to make it more commonplace just in regular investing as it is. So diversified funds like ours, I think, need to continue to look at this space as we are, and VC funds in general.
I think it's interesting. I wanted to ask you about some advice you might have for, you know, femtech startups that are looking to raise funds, but I almost also want to get your opinion on advice for, potential female, either angel investors or VC investors, you know, so both sides of that table, I feel like you could offer some good advice.
Yeah, I think as far as the founders go, you have to find someone who understands what you're trying to do. I think, you know, being really, really clear in describing what problem you're addressing, which sounds kind of funny, but I think sometimes what ends up happening as a woman and some of the companies that we've been pitched, they assume that the investors understand terms that they don't actually understand because they haven't been in that space. So on the fertility side, you know, people talking about LH and measuring your LH hormone, that's a hormone that you measure to see when you're about to ovulate. But a lot of male investors don't necessarily know what LH is. So just as an example, you know, I don't want to say dumbing it down, but bringing it down to a level where you're able to explain it to both sides of the coin. You're able to explain it to a woman. You're able to explain it to a man. You're able to explain it to someone who's never been through that. Really being strong in your messaging around that so that something's not getting missed, I think is important. I think look at the portfolios of these funds that you're going after and look at the type of companies that they have in there. And if you see companies that are somewhat related to what you're doing, that's probably a good place to start. I'm not saying limit yourself to that, but you will find that I think what ends up happening is when funds invest in femtech, they start to understand how big the space is and they want to continue to make those sort of investments. So if you look at a portfolio from any of these funds and you see something that's at all related to femtech, related to whatever you're doing, reach out to those ones first because it's not going to be as much of a hurdle necessarily. So I think, you know, that's where I would start. Make sure that the message that you're delivering in your deck and in your initial email addresses what you're doing in a way that's easy to understand for somebody who might have absolutely zero familiarity with it, and try to go after funds that have a shown track record of investing in this space, even if that's just one company. And then your other question on the investor side, I think you asked women who are interested in getting involved in angel investing, correct? Yeah. I would say just, you know, we've talked at Halo Fund about how to get more women in investing. I think that it's a conversation that's being had by a lot of people. People want to bring women into this. So I would say if you're a woman who's at all interested in this space, just start reaching out to people. Reach out to your local angel network. They would be happy, I'm sure, to let you come attend a meeting and to start, you know, getting in that conversation. Reach out to, you know, there's a lot of accelerators. Whatever your background is, reach out to those accelerators and say that you're willing to start talking to companies, and then you'll start sort of learning it. On our side, we're trying to, you know, put together kind of virtual lunch and learns, I guess is what you would call it, where we're bringing some of our companies onto the call and we're talking to them about what they do. So we're starting to try to familiarize just any investor in general about what early stage investing looks like. But I would say as a woman, if you're interested at all in the space, just start trying to get involved in it because there are so many avenues in which to learn more about it. If you're interested in learning about Halo and what we do, just reach out directly to me and I would be happy to add you onto our emailing list. And then you'll start to see the companies that we're investing in. And if you want to see them, you'll start to see our due diligence reports. We share that with people if they're interested. So we do like to educate people about, you know, what angel investing looks like. But I would just say, just, you know, Google it and wherever you happen to be and start trying to get involved. In Houston, you know, there are a lot of different areas that you can get involved. There are a lot of free events you can attend. There's a lot of startup showcases, opportunities to be mentors. So just start getting your feet wet because you can do a lot of it without having to write any check and you can get more and more familiar with it. And then when you are ready, you can start to take that next step.
That's great advice. Like, look for those opportunities to get involved. And going back to something you said earlier about, you know, the opportunities that COVID has provided. I mean, a lot of this is happening online where it hasn't been happening before, or it's been happening online maybe, but in just like tighter circles now due to COVID and due to social distancing, there's just more opportunities online. So that's really great advice. I appreciate that. And I appreciate your time today. I think we covered a lot of important information and I'm just so thankful for your time today and for really explaining this to our audience and diving into FinTech in general. I think just talking about it, we've changed some minds. We've educated some people, right? So thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. And thank you for everything you're doing with Innovation Map to bringing, you know, startups and entrepreneurship and all that's going on in Houston to the forefront.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Houston Innovators Podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss next week's edition, and check out innovationmap.com for the latest Houston startup and innovation news.